Thank you, Richard. And I have to say, like Richard, that I am astounded at how many people would come out just to look at pictures of swamps. It's amazing. When we come to look at the natural world through an historical lens, there can be no more fitting subject to study or exhibit than a swamp. And in the case of Melbourne, the very best example of a swamp must surely be that large wetland that lay spread across more than 30 hectares on the immediate west of the town. West Melbourne Swamp, or Batman Swamp, as it was often called, is a fitting subject to both study and exhibit because there are many stories that can be told about this feature. This wetland, among the many that once dotted the Port Phillip landscape, had the greatest presence and received most attention. It also was the scene of a wide spectrum of activities ranging from grazing cattle to operating noxious industries, cutting canals and laying down railways, as well as making bricks and creating fancy ceramic objects. It is a fitting subject also because historically, the role of wetlands and their place within the natural world, at least as understood by humans, has varied markedly through time. Our perceptions of swamps, and hence our attitudes towards such places, is quintessentially a function of the cultural frameworks within which we operate. So, to study what has been done to swamps in the past, to relate stories involving waterscapes such as West Melbourne Swamp, is to reveal changes that have occurred in the relationships between humans and nature. It's also timely that this exhibition has been mounted now, if perhaps ironically so. In less than 2 weeks' time, we will mark World Wetlands Day. Since 1997, the 2nd of February has been celebrated as the anniversary of the signing of the Convention on Wetlands. This event took place in Ramsar, a small city in northern Iran, in 1971. That an international agreement on the protection of wetlands can be put in place says something about how we now regard these natural features. And it certainly bespeaks a completely different view of these places than was taken of West Melbourne Swamp. The contemporary view is relatively new and is based on principles of ecology and a scientific understanding of the function and value of wetlands. With a different understanding and a change in attitude comes a change in how we refer to the objects of our study. The English language provides a plethora of words that can be used to refer to features such as West Melbourne Swamp. But of course, they don't all name or suggest the same thing, and many of the terms are value-laden. I don't want to become bogged down in this, but nowadays, calling something a swamp isn't the same as calling it a lagoon. In today's world, terms such as swamp, bog, marsh, and morass are pejorative, so the neutral, if somewhat bland, wetland is preferred. But whatever the terms we use to refer to these waterscape features, we express a markedly different attitude to them than that held by either Melbourne's 19th century immigrant population or the indigenous clans in whose country the settlement of Melbourne was created. For the people of the Kulin Nation, this swamp was of prime importance. The abundant seasonal resources available in and around West Melbourne Swamp and other wetlands in the general area were the mainstay of regular gatherings of Kulin clans. These gatherings were an essential element of the Kulin world, but would have been a much more difficult exercise without these highly productive features in their country. Wetlands such as this provided a sufficient range and quantity of foodstuffs, plants of medicinal use, and materials of practical value to support hundreds of people for a period of weeks. Whenever Kulin clans gathered in this region, the clans of each of four language groups set up camp in a particular location. These places were favoured by tradition and were all adjacent to extensive wetlands. In this way, members of the Wathawurrung clans from the Bellarine Peninsula generally camped on the rising ground at the western end of what is now Lonsdale Street, an area that overlooked the waterscape that came to be called West Melbourne Swamp. For most of Melbourne's early settlers, however, the many wetland areas that closely abutted the town were of no economic or cultural value. The swamps could not be farmed or built upon, as you said, and neither could they be put to the same uses as rivers and lakes. Moreover, these waterscapes were thought to be a source of disease. So when they were not being ignored or avoided, wetlands were used as dumping grounds for the unwanted detritus, and in many instances, sewage, from Melbourne's burgeoning communities. Of course, this only served to make the wetlands even more unattractive and a greater threat to the health of residents. In the earliest years of the settlement, West Melbourne Swamp posed a physical barrier to the westward extension of the town. Because it was prone to flooding, the initial plan for the area was to have it form part of an arc of crown land encircling the settlement, a large area reserved as parks or for recreational purposes. But the swamp remained as an impediment to such development locally, and this grand scheme never fully came to fruition. But from the earliest days of settlement, the open grassy flats that were an integral part of the swamp offered usable space for sporting activities. It was on these grassy flats at the foot of Batman's Hill that Melbourne's reputation as the sporting capital of Australia, if not the world, had its foundation. The first horse race in Melbourne was run on the 8th of February 1837 on a track marked out near the northern edge of Batman's Hill. Race meetings conducted by the Melbourne Race Club continued at that track until 1839, before being transferred to Flemington in early 1840. At about the same time, Melbourne's first cricket pitch was marked out and the first matches played. The exact location of the field is not recorded, but the sources all agree that it was somewhere near Batman's Hill, and the flat ground around the base of the hill seems a good bet. Oh, okay. I can't see my notes. For a period of about 30 years, beginning in the late 1840s, there were regular calls to reclaim the swamp, but the government continued to sit on its hands and made no concerted efforts to that end. In the meantime, industries of various kinds were established around the edges of the swamp. Noxious industries, based on the sheep and wool trade, used the river as a means of flushing away their effluent. But in some parts of the swamp, there were workable deposits of clay of a quality and quantity that could be used in making bricks and pottery. In the 1850s and 60s, at the foot of the hill sloping down from the Hotham Benevolent Asylum, Henry Stevenson operated the North Melbourne Pottery. Here, the clay was said to be quite equal to the best material found in Staffordshire. Among the fine quality products produced in the pottery were models of a variety of fruits, vegetables, and other products grown in the colony to be used as display items in exhibitions. It's a pity that none of these have survived, because they'd make a wonderful addition to the display. Also during the 1850s, closer to the Yarra River, Patrick Kelly established a pottery at a former brickworks site. For a couple of years, he was able to make use of what he said was the very best description of clay, equal to Devonshire, where the finest clay in England is found. So there's some dispute where the best comes from. Brickmakers had been active in that southern part of the swamp for some time, but in 1856, the Phoenix Brickworks was established on a site to the west of Stevenson's Pottery Works and close to the Melbourne to Mount Alexander and the Murray River train line. The construction of that railway, which began in 1854, was the first significant physical modification of the swamp, and it was during this work that a plentiful supply of fine white clay was exposed, a few feet below the bed of the lagoon. The Phoenix Brickworks were the first in Victoria to operate with mechanised brickmaking equipment. The worksite also became the scene of a bitter dispute within the group of men who were the original partners in the company. The dispute resulted in the deliberate burning down of the brickworks before a brick had been made. I hesitate to say before a brick had been fired, but and the subsequent charging of four men by the police. The owner of the brickworks, against whom the incendiarism was aimed, was Alexander Kennedy Smith, a man with interests in a number of ventures involving West Melbourne swamp. Smith was an engineer with the Melbourne Gas and Coke Company, whose gasworks were located close to the river on the southern edge of the swamp. He was also a member of the Philosophical Institute of Victoria, which is was renamed as the Royal Society of Victoria a couple of years later. And in 1858, he published a detailed paper in the Institute's Transactions titled On the Reclamation and Cultivation of Batman Swamp. The plan that accompanied the printed paper and which shows the means whereby the draining was to be achieved is reproduced as part of this exhibition. And it's that one over there. Like many another scheme to reclaim the swamp, this one came to nothing. It was the formation of the Melbourne Harbour Trust in 1877 that provided the impetus to create a viable port for Melbourne, and in the process drain and make profitable use of the West Melbourne swamp. Although cutting the Coote Canal did not impact directly on the area of the swamp, the greater facility the canal gave to the Port of Melbourne led to an extensive range of public works that soon led to a large portion of it being drained. Chief among these projects was the excavation of Victoria Dock. The digging took about 4 years, and in March 1892, the Governor of Victoria, Lord Hopetoun, had the honour of letting water flow into the dock for the first time. The Argus provides an amusing account of the event. And this is a quote from the paper. The Governor was instructed into the niceties of opening a dock. This His Excellency speedily mastered, and a few moments afterwards some particularly bad specimens of Yarra garbage were being borne into the basin by the stream of water. The Governor was alternately loudly cheered and subjected to good-natured badinage by the denizens of the swamp, who had assembled in great force. He was earnestly appealed to by several gentlemen, evidently belonging to the wharf labouring profession, to furnish liquid refreshments. And one person grew quite pathetic in his demands for beer as the water flowed into the dock. End quote. We're presented in this exhibition with a range of images which collectively display something of both the physical and conceptual form of West Melbourne swamp. In the first case, there are plans that show the original extent of the wetland, and in others that display how it was planned to reclaim that area. Over a period of some years of looking at images of the swamp, pondering over the subject, I'm probably more familiar than most with the range of possibilities. For this reason, I'm particularly taken with what must be the most recently constructed representation on the subject. This is the digital image on the end panel to my left. It is difficult sometimes to grasp from photographs and drawings the scale and size of natural features such as this wetland. But using GIS information and digital data sets is a way of combining information from two different time periods and scaling it to produce a helpful and illuminating image. A couple of the photographs here could be interpreted as pointing to a characteristic of the swamp that had no physical form. With only a couple of notable exceptions, all published comments on West Melbourne Swamp were negative. For many people, even after much of it had been reclaimed and turned over to industrial purposes, this swampy area continued to represent the uncivilised and somewhat nasty fringe at the edge of decent society. This view was confirmed, perhaps, for them during the Depression, when a small settlement sprang up on either side of the former railway canal. The residents of Dudley Mansions, as it was ironically called, unfortunate victims of hard times, could easily be seen as symbolic of the environmentally degraded surroundings in which they were forced to live. I'm delighted and excited to launch this exhibition. It focuses attention not only on one of the handful of landscape features that played a role in Melbourne's early development, but also on how these features were regarded and why it is that they have all vanished. West Melbourne Swamp may well have vanished from our sight, but not from our collective memory. The Society and the curator of this exhibition are to be commended for reminding us of aspects of Melbourne's past that deserve to be remembered. Thank you, and enjoy the exhibition.